Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When Baghdad fell, President George W. Bush was standing tall, the no-nonsense, plain-speaking president that Americans have looked to since 9/11 seemed politically invincible and had the poll numbers to back it up. But suddenly, the glow of victory is less bright, and the president's future a bit less certain. A stubbornly sluggish economy, credibility under attack, and a difficult occupation in Iraq are beginning to pull the president's approval rating down. Americans are now split 50-50 when it comes to trusting George Bush. The president still has deep, visceral support, many millions in campaign dollars, and the formidable power of incumbency. But for the first time in a long time, Democrats smell a whiff of hope in the air. Tonight on Point, the president's new margin of vulnerability. We begin tonight in Washington, where Pulitzer Prize-winning Washington Post columnist David Broder has been keeping a close watch on the Bush presidency and sees, against earlier expectations, the possibility of a real horse race in the 2004 election. I asked David Broder how the president's prospects look now.
They look pretty good. They look a little less bright than they did a few weeks ago, but as the incumbent with the unlimited resources, both political and financial, I would say he's not in bad shape, but I think we're still going to have an election that will be worth covering.
It wasn't so very long ago that President Bush was seen as essentially invulnerable. How does that characterization sound today?
I don't think that one applies at this point. I think the combination of a deteriorating economy, at least as far as the employment picture looks, and more worrisome news coming out of Iraq has raised doubts that were not there, say, a month or 6 weeks ago. And as you know, the administration's perhaps most precious commodity, its credibility, is also being tested these days in ways that were not true before.
You said if President Bush is not reelected somehow, that July 10th might seem in retrospect as the day the shadow of defeat first crossed his political horizon. What were the elements that caught your eye on that day, David Broder?
Well, the main things were the tone of the three major network television evening broadcasts that day, which were negative, negative, negative for the president on both the economy and Iraq, and some polls that happened to come out at the same time, which measured a significant drop in his support, both overall and particularly for his handling of the economy and the situation in Iraq. None of us knows whether these trends, which have continued in the last couple of weeks, are long-term or whether this is just something that will be reversed very quickly. But for the first time, I thought that there were signs that this election might not be the lay-down hand that many of us had thought it would be for the president.
You called the CBS Evening News that night something like Karl Rove's worst nightmare. And the three big pieces that you point to, David Broder, are the troubles of the U.S. occupation of Iraq, the president's credibility over claims that led to war with Iraq, and the economy. Speak to each of those and how you see them playing out in the chemistry that's going to surround George W. Bush as he heads into the next election.
Well, the economy is probably the most worrisome because economies don't turn around in short term. And while the statisticians will tell you that we are out of the recession, as far as people are concerned, in terms of their mindset and their life experiences, this is still a very tough time. We know that the measured unemployment rate of 6.4% is the highest that it has been in 7 or 8 years. But beyond that, there have been so many people that you meet when you're out reporting who have involuntarily been forced to change jobs. And for the most part, they find themselves working for lower wages or fewer hours than they did before. So the economic unease, I think, is probably the most significant part of the problem. Iraq is more difficult in the aftermath of major military operations than the military operations themselves. A lot of smart people who know much more about that region than I will ever know had said he is weaker militarily than he was 10 years ago. We can clean him up militarily, But governing that country and putting it back on its feet is going to be a serious long-term challenge, and we better be ready for the cost that that entails.
And it's proving to be so far exactly that. What about the credibility issue? Do you think that has legs?
I'm not sure about that, because the president had built up great goodwill and a great amount of trust in the days immediately after the 9/11 attack. That credibility is being challenged in terms of the explanation for why we went to war when we did. But the jury is still out as to whether and how long-lasting the damage to his credibility may be.
David Broder, you've been watching presidents and presidential candidates for a long time. This George Bush has been described as a lucky president, and there's been a lot of attention paid to the special kind of chemistry that he has that seems pretty deep with at least part of the American electorate, a substantial part of the American electorate. What do you think of his luck and his chemistry at this point?
Well, I'm not sure about luck, although that certainly enters in ultimately to any president's fate. Jimmy Carter had notably bad luck in his presidency, but luck is, as some wise person said, the residue of effort. But the chemistry has clearly been part of his appeal. He comes across as a very plain-spoken, straightforward person, and that's why the credibility question now becomes potentially important, because that has been such a sort of source of strength for him.
How would you look at the rest of the strong suit in George Bush's hand?
Well, the basic strength that he has is what he earned in the days after the attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. That was the most severe crisis that this generation of Americans has seen, and his stepping up to it in the way that he did by declaring that this was a challenge to the nation that would be met, and then taking the kind of leadership that he showed in those first few days, I think builds a bond that is going to be very difficult for opponents to weaken or attack. His performance on domestic issues has been not nearly as strong, and his reliance on a particular form of tax cutting as the way to try to right this economy is clearly running into serious questions, not just because the economy is not right yet, but because the deficits are now reaching a scale that begin to look a little bit frightening to people who look beyond the next week or month in terms of where this country is headed.
But is it possible that given that chemistry of George Bush, that he has a bond that transcends performance with a substantial number of voters?
Yes, he does have that bond with a very substantial number of voters. But the other thing that's happened, as we know, is that he has become a much more polarizing president. When he ran in 2000, I think most people, including most Democrats, thought, well, I may or may not agree with him, but he seems like a good fellow, and he's not somebody who's going to rock the boat very dramatically. He's turned out to be much more ambitious in terms of policy change and much more controversial in terms of political effect than we had imagined, or at least than I had imagined, when he was a candidate in 2000.
But looking out today, David Broder, you see, while still many strengths, the possibility of a horse race that was not so apparent very recently.
Yes, I think this is going to be an election that's worth covering. We knew it was going to be a high-stakes election from the Republican viewpoint, because their goal is not simply to reelect George Bush, but to establish themselves as the new majority party in the country. But now I begin to see the possibility of a kind of a mobilization on the Democratic side to defeat that effort that looks to me as if it's going to be much more interesting and perhaps more consequential than most second-term elections turn out to be.
David Broder, we'll have to have you back some evening to talk about that Democratic side, but thanks so much for your thoughts on President Bush tonight.
Thank you.
David Broder is a Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The Washington Post. He spoke with us earlier from Washington. We're talking tonight about President Bush's new margin of political vulnerability. A Time CNN poll released this week puts the president's approval rating at just 55%, a major come down for a president whose poll numbers have spent a lot of time in the stratosphere. When it comes to trusting President Bush, 51% now say they have doubts about George W. President Bush remains a powerful incumbent with wide support, but not the support he had just 2 months ago. Is the president looking suddenly vulnerable, or is that wishful Democratic thinking? Has your view of the president changed in the past month or not? And will the president's strengths outweigh and outlast a dip in the polls? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Century Foundation, a progressive think tank and policy center in Washington. He's author of The Emerging Democratic Majority. Good evening and welcome, Rui Teixeira.
Glad to be here.
Great to have you. Rui Teixeira, when you look at the president's prospects now and the poll numbers that underlie those prospects, what do you see?
Well, kind of some of the things you were alluding to are, I think, are very clearly real and very clearly indicate, as Broder was saying, that the election in 2004 is likely to be a horse race. When you've got your approval rating falling as far and as fast as his is, when you've got his approval rating on the economy as bad as it is, but also his approval rating, even on things like foreign affairs, headed south very rapidly, and when you have the erosion of the trust factor, very critical. I mean, Bush has avoided blame, or that blame has, he's been cut a lot of slack by voters, partly because of the idea that, though he's a good guy, he's really trying hard, he's been a strong leader, I trust him and the decisions he's made.
Mm-hmm.
And now that's really starting to be called into question. People are wondering, you know, what's going on in Iraq, where we're headed, why soldiers are still dying, what was the story with the WMDs, why can't we find them, and were we really told the truth to begin with? And no one of those things by themselves, would push his ratings down as far as they have, but together, I think they're starting to have an effect where just the that Teflon coating that he's been enjoying for so long is clearly wearing off. And, he's a mere mortal. He's a president, and he's got to produce. And if he's held to those kinds of standards, just what has he done and how much has he accomplished and where are we? He looks a lot less strong than when he's got this sort of belt in, I'll give him a break because he's a strong leader and he got us through 9/11.
So Rui,
I think really changes the landscape.
Rui, you follow the poll numbers pretty closely. You follow from a Democratic perspective, but with a lot of experience. Take us into the numbers. Give us some specifics. What's happened? What's the story of George Bush and the polls?
Well, again, it depends on which indicator you want to look at. I mean, you can look at things like the right direction, wrong track indicator of where do people see the country going. People are now convinced the country's on the wrong track.
By what kind of margin?
Hmm?
By what kind of margin there,
oh,
for
well,
example?
Right now it's just headed south. It's just gotten into negative territory. So in the most recent Democracy Corps survey, it was -6. But he was enjoying right direction pluralities of up to 15 or 20 points during the Iraq War. In the Iraq War itself, his approval rating on handling the situation with Iraq was, in this 65-70% range, and now it's down in the 50s. Same thing with foreign affairs. His approval rating hit about 70%, depending, again, on which poll you look at. And it's probably the average drop in most polls has been around, 12 to 15 points. So he's now down in the mid-50s, as you were alluding to. The CNN Time poll shows him at 55%. The Democracy Corp poll that was just released has him at 55%. That's kind of the range he's probably in now. If he keeps on going down at the rate he is, he would be below 50% very soon. But even if he starts dropping again at the rate of only 1 point a month, he'll be below 50% before the end of this year. So, and then that's a danger zone for the incumbent. And his approval ratings in the economy are already below 50%. But that overall approval rating, which captures not just people's feelings about the economy, but also their feelings about the overall general job he's doing, including foreign affairs, including Iraq, including handling the country overall. I mean, when that really starts headed south, as it has been, that's trouble.
At this point in a presidency, is a 55-point approval rating good, bad, medium?
Actually, a 55% approval rating is about the historical average for presidents at all time. So it's not even a good approval rating anymore. It's just sort of like mediocre.
Is George Bush beatable next year? Is he beatable, Rui Teixeira?
Hmm?
Is George Bush beatable next year?
Oh, absolutely. Italy is beatable. I mean, you'd have to look at the terrain now, and you'd have to look at the way the Republicans have reestablished that advantage on national security. And you probably still have to say he's got a real good chance of getting reelected. But is it a 70% chance or even a 60% chance? Probably not. This is probably going to be a very competitive election.
Rui Teixeira, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're looking tonight at President Bush's new margin of vulnerability as the country heads toward a new race. For the White House, you can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking tonight at President Bush's new margin of vulnerability as the country heads toward a new race for the White House. You can join the conversation tonight. Is the president looking suddenly vulnerable, or is that wishful Democratic thinking? Has your opinion of George W. Bush changed in the last month, and how can George Bush be beaten in 2004? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We heard earlier from David Broder of The Washington Post. We've been talking with Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Century Foundation and co-author with John Judas of The Emerging Democratic Majority. We're joined now from Washington by Mona Charon. She's a nationally syndicated conservative columnist, author of Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America. First, good evening and welcome, Mona Charon.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for joining us, Mona. You have no doubt heard the buzz in the last week or two. All those who thought George Bush had it locked up, or some of their number, are now saying suddenly, wait a minute, maybe there's some light here between George Bush and the White House. Is the president vulnerable?
Well, first of all, any political analyst who, more than a year before the next election, describes anybody as a shoo-in or a sure thing really ought to hang up his political prognosticator cleats, because you cannot predict that far out. And just ask George H.W. Bush about his second term.
No kidding. But yet, you know, what a juggernaut feel there was about this administration
recently. Well, that's right. And you know what? Sometimes the conventional wisdom is correct. I mean, Everybody said during the primaries that George W. Bush had it locked up, and it turned out that he did, though there were several serious bumps in the road that McCain provided. But In any event, I think that the president's conduct over the last couple of weeks has not given may have given an opportunity for his critics to make some hay, because I think in a surprise, really, for an administration that has been pretty sure-footed in its handling of public relations, they have just handled this whole Niger thing horribly, abominably.
The so-called credibility issue.
Well, they've just, no, it's not that. It's that they have been fumbling around and changing their story from day to day and seeming very defensive. And
it really took over the president's Africa trip, but it is about credibility, isn't it? I mean, isn't that why it's playing so hot?
I actually think the whole thing is ridiculously overblown. I mean, it was one tiny part, a one thread, if you will, of a huge quilt of evidence and reasons that we had for taking on Saddam Hussein. And whether or not it turns out in the end to have been accurate, or, you know, whether maybe the president shouldn't have included it in the speech, so what?
Why do you think this thing, Mona Charon, has President Bush's crew so apparently flustered?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, maybe all the smart political people were on summer vacation. I really have a hard time understanding why they've been so flustered. What they needed to do is get out there and say, you know, we did absolutely the right thing, which is kind of what Cheney said the other day. Who would do anything different with this evidence? I mean, you know, here we are sort of mopping our brows and stroking our chins and wondering about whether we missed evidence before September 11th that we really ought to have taken more seriously. And, you know, the answer is yes, we did. Well, now we're trying to take everything very seriously. You know, you don't have to have, you shouldn't have, in my opinion, an imminent threat to this country before you act. You should be able to look down the road and say, this is a medium to long-term threat that we'd better deal with now while it's manageable, rather than wait and let the threat grow more and more threatening and perhaps even become imminent. In the age of of nuclear weapons in the hands of, conceivably in the hands of terrorists, we can't afford to wait and be hit first and then respond.
And Mona Charon, what about the other two chinks in the armor, as described in the last few weeks? One, the deteriorating economy, and secondly, this worrisome situation in Iraq. Neither of these easy to quickly mend or shake off.
Well, tough trouble
for the president?
The economy is a problem. That is without any question. Presidents always get the credit for good economies and the blame for bad ones, whether they've earned it and deserve it or not. And surely the president would dearly like to see the economy rebounding. I think the messages, by the way, from the economy are quite mixed. I mean, it isn't all bad news at all. Unemployment is, new claims for unemployment compensation are down. I mean, there are other signs that the economy is actually rebounding, but they're mixed. So, yes, of course, the economy can always hurt a president, and he always has to be mindful of that, and, you know, for whatever good it does him. I mean, I'm not sure that there's much he can do anyway to improve the economy. But regarding the situation in Iraq, I mean, I think this is a complete invention on the part of the press that things are going badly. The fact is, things are going quite well. And, you know, yes, Americans are being killed, and that's not worrisome, but it's lamentable and it's terrible. And every single time an American is killed, we all feel it. But we are in the process of draining a swamp over there. The Iraqis, we shouldn't expect them to thank us. I mean, you know, this is a very primitive society in many ways, but they will thank us eventually. And more important than that, we're doing this for our own long-term security and for the world's. We're trying to remake the region that has been the cauldron of this vicious and murderous anti-Americanism.
Rui Teixeira, let me bring you back in here. What about it? President Bush's sudden appearance of problems are a matter of bad PR and inventions of the press.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's remotely plausible. I mean, if you look at the simplest hypothesis in a situation like this is not that the press made it up, but that what's being reported is actually pretty reflective of reality, and that reality is being processed by the public, and they have a real and negative reaction to it. When they look at the Iraq situation and they see people getting killed and they see no plausible out strategy and they see the country still in chaos, they wonder what it all means and whether it was worth it. When they look at the economy and they see 6.4% unemployment and they see not much improvement despite two huge tax cuts in 2001 and 2003, that brings Bush's economic stewardship into question. I think it's about real facts being reported by the press and then processed by the public. I think that's a much more simpler and more plausible theory than saying somehow the public is being led around by the nose by the press. I just don't buy it at all.
Rui Teixeira, Mona Charon, let's hear from some citizens out there. Kevin's calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for letting me contribute to your show.
Good to have you.
I have a quick comment and a question. The comment is that, to a certain extent, the change in popularity isn't surprising. Presidents always do well in times of crisis, in black and white times, in wartime, and they always do less well when the foe is not as clearly defined. Presidents always do well with a good economy, and they always do poorly with a poor one. So, to a certain extent, I think that the luck that was mentioned earlier, the situations the president finds himself in, plays a role.
So is he in a strong position now, do you think, Kevin, or not?
I think that he's currently in a weaker position, but it's not clear which way the economy is going, and it's not clear what's going to happen in Iraq in the next 6 months. And by the time the election rolls around, it'll be very difficult to say how popular it will be. And it's not clear how much it will be in the president's control and how much it will be in the control of how quickly Iraq becomes acceptable.
Well, sure. All of that is unclear. But what's the nut of your observation here, Kevin?
I think that we might be overcalling transient changes in the president's popularity based on what's going on now, when in fact, when the election happens, everything could be completely different.
Got it. And that takes us to this issue of George Bush's fundamental kind of relationship with the American people, or at least a substantial part of that population, Mona Charon. How would you describe that? David Broder was saying earlier that this is a president who was seen as plain-spoken, straightforward, no nonsense, and that had a lot to do with his deep base of support. Is that still intact? Do you expect him to take that into the 2004 elections or not?
Oh, I do think that he forged a very firm and lasting relationship with the American people after September 11th. And that relationship is not ephemeral. Now, that's not to say that it's impermeable and that events will not have an effect. Of course, they can, but no, I think people took their measure of him and sense that he is fundamentally straightforward and honest, and that he has the country's best interests at heart, and that he makes decisions based on what he genuinely thinks is best for the country and not for his own political best interests.
Mm. But Rui Teixeira, you know, of course, a president can strike a pose that looks noble in one context and goofy or disingenuous in another. Might George Bush walk into that kind of world where the pose he struck to comfort the country after 9/11 no longer redounds in the same way to his benefit?
Well, I think that's eminently possible. And if you look at the bond that Bush has struck with the American people, it is so sort of based in that immediate 9/11 period, moving into Afghanistan, getting the Taliban, a pretty successful and unambiguous operation. Ever since then, the political challenge for the Republicans has been to bottle that and keep it on the shelf right where they want it. But, it's eroded gradually, but they sort of managed to pump it back up with the Iraq War, and of course they started pumping it up at a very convenient time in the fall, right before the 2002 election. But the problem with this is you get people all hot and bothered, you put a lot of stuff out there into the mix about how we have to move into Iraq, then you do move into Iraq, then things don't turn out that well, there are still problems, issues of credibility come to the fore, and you've already invaded Iraq, there's no obvious country to invade next, and you're kind of stuck on the ground with the real consequences of your actions. And those consequences may or may not be good ones. Maybe at this point they're turning out not to be so good, but you're sort of stuck. You're being judged on that basis, and it's taking people away from the view they originally formed of you right after September 11th. That is the problem. They put a lot of the chips on that, and now that bet is starting to pay off in a different way.
Mona Charan?
Can I make 2 points?
Please.
One is that, with the death of Uday and Qusay, mm-hmm. and the sense of a tightening noose around Saddam himself, the news from Iraq could change very dramatically over the next several weeks. If Saddam is killed or captured, if they find the weapons of mass destruction, then everyone will agree, as I already think, but I think everyone then will universally agree that it was a resounding success.
Well maybe, but everyone would wish for that, but yet attacks have continued to go on even in these 2 days since Uday and Qusay were killed.
That is true. There are still, they had plenty of thugs to run that place for 30 years, and we haven't gotten them all. And we may have made some mistakes, in our initial occupation, by failing to go after the right people and to assume that they were simply going to melt away, which they didn't. But leaving that aside for a second, the president is going to have a Democratic opponent. And as it looks right now, all of the Democrats are not moving to the, of course, we need to have, take these foreign policy threats seriously. Of course, we have to make security our number one priority. Instead, under the influence of Howard Dean, they seem to be moving left and being more and more critical of the president, so much so that Bill Clinton, who, say what you will about him, always had a good sense of America's political pulse, has been critical of them and has said, you really can't ignore that.
Watch out, guys. Watch where you're going. We have callers who want to speak to just that. David's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Two questions, one to each guest.
Yes.
To the Progressive Foundation.
Rui Teixeira, yes.
Century Foundation.
The Century, I'm sorry. Let's say your hypothesis is correct, and Bush is on the ropes at election time. Which piece of white bread do you pull out of the bag to run against him? Because as it stands now, I think the last poll I saw was that if you ran a non-committed Hillary Clinton against all, 30 candidates the Democrats have, she sweeps them. And, she hasn't made that commitment mm-hmm. yet. And to be quite honest, and I say this as a Republican, and it gives me the shivers to think of Hillary Clinton as president, but she's really about the only dynamic candidate that the Democrats seem to have at this point.
David, let us go at that one first, and stand by. We'll put you in touch with Mona Charon as well. But what about it, Rui Teixeira? David Broder's piece noted a poll in which two-thirds of those surveyed could not even name a single one of the nine Democrats vying for the right to oppose Clinton.
Yeah, well, that's common at this stage. That's really par for the course. People don't really start paying attention to these primary contests until quite a bit later. You know, it starts in the fall, and then it really doesn't even pick up until the beginning of next year. So the fact that most people can't name even, say, John Kerry or Howard Dean is trivial and of no importance. The issue is, you know, if you look at the people who it looks like are going to run, I mean, leaving Hillary out of the equation, can any of those sort of capture people's doubts about Bush, speak to the both mobilize the Democratic base and speak to the center, speak to those disaffected independent moderate voters who are starting to really feel maybe it's time for a change. And, you know, my judgment on that is yes, that you know, there are several Democratic candidates who could probably do a good job. Which one of those will find standing, you know, when it gets to be nomination time, I don't know. But I think these are, you know, this is a pretty good set of candidates. And, you know, I don't know which one's going to get nominated, but I think they'll get Bush a run for their money.
Well, so Rui's ready to bet on one of those slices. David, you had a call from Mona Charon as well, or a question.
And then, Ms. Charon, I think as a Republican, I'm concerned because, I mean, we can take this nonchalant attitude that, oh, you know, once we tighten the noose around Saddam's neck, I mean, the fact of the matter, at election time, body bags of our boys and girls by the dozens coming home a week, okay, and moths in the pocketbook don't bode well.
Mona Charon, are you back from dog patrol there?
Sorry about that.
No problem. But here's David, a Republican in Wisconsin, looking out at what could come out of Iraq and feeling uneasy.
Here's the thing. You know, most American commentators and observers above a certain age are still stuck in the Vietnam template, namely body bags equals an unpopular war equals unrest at home and so on. The reason that Americans, and I wrote a book about this recently, Useful Idiots, and I've just gone through all of the data. The reason that people turned against the war in Vietnam, and by the way, a majority never did, but that's another matter. The reason is not because there were casualties, but because the casualties seemed for no good end. We weren't trying to win, okay? And so why you want to keep sending your young men off to be killed for no purpose? That was what made the war unpopular. This is an entirely different matter. We are losing people, and that's painful. But you know what? The world is threatening, and we can either lose them in our cities, jumping out of tall buildings, or we can lose soldiers. And I think most people would say that we'd rather send the Army, the Navy, and the Marines to do this fighting than have our civilians die.
David, let me ask you, in Madison, is that a persuasive argument to you as an uneasy Republican looking at those deaths?
No, it's not, because I'm all for striking at a threat. And when you strike hard and you strike decisively. I guess I come from more of a Powell doctrine. Nation building, which we were told, at least I was, by my party, we were not going to engage in. But here we are doing it. We're doing it in a country that we're obviously not popular in. Even if we were to sweep away the Baathists, I'm not entirely convinced that there are not transnationals operating in this country at this point. I just don't want to see us in a quagmire. Now, you can look at all the data you want, but the fact of the matter, as these things continue, and let's not blow off the economy, because I think this is tied to this as well, my concern is, you know, you can't keep trying to ride the poll numbers. Something has to be done. Something has to be done decisively. And it needs to look as though now the president is in charge.
David, we've got to take a break here. We thank you for your call. There's a Republican voter speaking out. We're talking tonight about President Bush's new margin of vulnerability. What are the president's abiding strengths? And is the president's vulnerability sufficient to offset the Democrats' invisibility? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about President Bush's new margin of vulnerability as the country heads toward a new race for the White House. My guests tonight, Mona Charon, joining us from Washington. She's nationally syndicated columnist, author of Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America First. And from Washington, Rui Teixeira, senior fellow at the Century Foundation and co-author of The Emerging Democratic Majority. You can join the conversation as well. What's the softest spot in the Bush administration's armor now? Iraq, credibility, the economy, none of the above? And does Bush, the defender of national security, have a lock on core support that transcends all other issues? Is that still working for him? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Andrew's calling from Cold Spring, Wisconsin. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Yes. Good evening.
Good evening.
What sticks in my mind is not 16 words, but 3 words said a few weeks ago. Bring them on. At the time, okay, to be honest, I'm a grassroots Democrat in the state of Wisconsin, so I feel probably as lonely as my colleague David does in Madison. But those words struck me as being very cavalier at the time. By my calculations, the death toll in the post-combat phase of Iraq will far exceed those in the combat phase well before the elections come around. I think those words are going to come back to haunt the president. It's not only cavalier, but cold, callous, and foolish.
Andrew, we've got it. Let me put it to my guests. Mona Charon, first to you. I mean, it's interesting. The president's kind of bluff, blunt, let's have at it personality in some ways seemed very warmly welcomed by much of the country for months after 9/11.
Yep.
Is it possible that, that very core asset that's worked for him could turn against him in the context of what's going on in Iraq?
No, I think it's liberals who don't like it and never have liked it. I mean, our caller is so typical. You know, he finds it, I forget the words he used, cold and callous or something?
Yes, and cavalier.
Cavalier. We are talking about the people that Bush was addressing are terrorists and thugs and murderers who worked for one of the most vicious regimes in the world. I mean, our caller would not have liked the fact that Winston Churchill said about the Nazis, we shall fight them on the beaches, we shall fight them in the fields, and so he would have said that that was too bellicose.
Well, I wonder. I mean, that seems an extreme interpretation. Bring it on, you know, it's a different time. It's a different circumstance.
Yeah, let me mention a poll finding here, if I may.
Rui Teixeira, yeah.
CNN Time poll you alluded to earlier, and we mm-hmm. discussed a bit, they actually asked people, well, what did you think of what Bush said in terms of bring them on, good idea or bad idea? By 55% to 36%, in other words, by almost 20 points, they said it was a bad idea. So I guess it didn't exactly get the we'll fight them on the beaches type reaction from the American public.
It certainly doesn't seem to have. But Mona, you're a thoughtful person. I mean, I want to put the same question. Isn't it possible that, you know, chest out, jaw out thing that was so comforting after 9/11, and it really was, to a lot of people, could become, in some dimension, a negative for this president?
Well, I would say only if he's unsuccessful. I think that that's the ticket. I mean, if, mm-hmm. if he succeeds in Iraq, if the country begins to be pacified, mm-hmm. and as I believe it will, I think the military has learned what it did wrong and is quickly correcting that. They recognize that going after the top leadership of al-Qaeda right from the beginning was a mistake, and they've decided to go looking for the middle-level people. Mm. Sorry, not of al-Qaeda. I mean of the Ba'ath.
The Ba'ath Party.
They've started looking for the middle-level people, and this has led to a trove of information that led them to the two sons of Saddam and so on. So I think the military has figured out what they did wrong. I think that they are getting their act together. Who knows how long it will take, but success will be the measure. I mean, if the president is successful, if America's policy is mm-hmm. successful in Iraq, mm-hmm. then people will not find that you know, tough guy stance cloying. They'll think it's appropriate. If he's a failure, if there continue to be deaths day after day after day with no sense of a waning of the problem and just a sort of endless, you know, drip, drip, drip of casualties, yes, that will be a problem.
That will be hard to spin. Paul's calling from Newport, Rhode Island. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I initially called to talk about media bias, which I'll make a comment on, but I have got to respond to some of the comments that Mona made. First, she tried to diminish the 16 words to say it's not a big deal. I would agree, it's not a big deal in the context of the fact that he also misled us about weapons of mass destruction and al-Qaeda connection. So it's the tip of the iceberg in terms of the deception.
Do you think Bill Clinton misled us when he explained that he was bombing Iraq because of their weapons of mass destruction and was bombing the weapons of mass destruction sites?
Look, we know that there is no even the 9/11 report said there was no connection to al-Qaeda. There have been no WMDs found. The nuclear threat was forged. Okay, let's. But
we take your point. You didn't like the 16 words or the context around them. But what's your broader sense of what's happening here, Paul?
Well, Mona also mentioned that we're going into Iraq to justify the war. She's saying we're going to Iraq to get into the hotbed of anti-Americanism by doing what? By doing exactly what makes us hated. Pushing around the Arab world, and that's exactly why we're hated.
It's pushing them around, of course, all we do is toady to the Arab world. Look at the way we treat the Saudis.
No, the reason President Bush said to the United States, he said, I quote, that they hate our freedom. What they hate is not our freedom. What they hate is what we do, and it goes a long way back.
Such as
the Western world has basically pushed the Arabs around. Ever
How?
Since the First World War. Well, why don't you just read a history book and then you'll find out.
The United States has pushed around the Arab world?
The other thing I wanted to mention is on 9/11, also tried to justify the war.
Caller, how can you... No, you said the United States has pushed the Arab world around.
I said
around.
The Western world.
I want to know
world.
How.
The Western world has pushed around the Arab...
Well, the Western
world
is... That's why... That's a different thing.
Paul and Mona, we're not going to settle that one here tonight, I'm afraid. But, Paul, you initially called in with a question about media bias. What was your question there, you said?
Well, I read two sets of books. I read one set of book called saying that there's a liberal bias. It's called One Bias by Bernard Goldberg.
Sure.
Slander and Coulter, Coloring the News, William McGowan.
Yeah, take us to your bottom line, Paul. Our time's short.
I also read What Liberal Media by Eric Alterman, which has far more cogent argument. And I think in terms of foreign policy and the Iraq war, that the media is far, far more biased towards the right wing.
So you see it all wrapped up in a media envelope that's favorable to George Bush. Rudy Teixeira, how do you interpret that?
Well, my sense of media bias is frequently it reflects less a liberal or conservative slant in the mainstream media more than sort of what's the conventional wisdom, what's going on right now, what's the big story. There's a certain reluctance to challenge the status quo and the administration in Washington when big things are up. And I think that accounts for some of the way the press has been a little bit hands-off with Bush. I don't think they're out to move a conservative agenda. I certainly don't think the opposite is true. But I think what's happening now is that a lot of the things that Bush said, and this is, where the 16 words come in, and things like that, they're being scrutinized carefully. People are looking at documents. People are going back and interviewing people, and they're realizing that there is a story there, and they're reporting it to people, and people are saying, gee,
Rui,
I wish I'd known this before.
Rui, let me ask you very quickly.
They said there was a nuclear threat, and there isn't, apparently.
Rui, we're almost out of time. I want to ask you very quickly, how do the politics have to work here for this to happen? Who needs to swing to the Democrats for one of these nine to take the White House?
Well, two things have to happen. You have to have a candidate who's going to tap into the sort of energy of the Democratic base and bring them out in droves. But secondly, absolutely, you're going to have a candidate who can speak to moderate and independent voters, particularly in the battleground states, particularly in your Ohio's and Missouri's and Pennsylvania's and your Iowa's and your Minnesota's. I mean, I think these are, you could argue the median voter, if you're looking at it strictly in national security terms, it said as we went into the Iraq war, it was not somebody who absolutely vigorously opposed the Iraq war down the line. It was somebody who said, I've got my problems with it. I got my hesitations. I'm not sure we're doing the right thing. I wish maybe
And so off it went there. Mona Sharon, last word to you. Would you bet the farm on President Bush's victory?
I wouldn't bet the farm on anything, but I would say that the Democrats have a structural problem now, which is national defense. Throughout the 1990s, that issue was taken off the table. Even then, they were only able to win by squeakers. Now that it's back on the
squeakers.
Table, they have a real problem because they are perceived as the party of weakness.
Mona Charon, Rui Teixeira, we're out of time, but I thank you both for joining us. Mona Charon is author of Useful Idiots, How Liberals Got It Wrong in the Cold War and Still Blame America First. Rui Teixeira, author of The Emerging Democratic Majority. In a moment, President Bush welcomes Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas to Washington. This is On Point. The new Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas made his first visit to the White House today to meet with President Bush. Abbas thanked Bush for $20 million in direct U.S. assistance recently granted to the Palestinians and for what he called Bush's relentless efforts in pursuit of peace. President Bush told Abbas that the United States was committed to ensuring free and secure states for both Palestine and Israel. Bush urged leaders in the region to be accountable for peace and progress. Here are excerpts from the press conference following today's meeting.
To break through old hatreds and barriers to peace, the Middle East needs leaders of vision and courage and determination to serve the interests of their people. Mr. Abbas is the first Palestinian prime minister, and he is proving to be such a leader. We had a good meeting today about the way forward on the roadmap to Middle Eastern peace. Prime Minister Abbas and I share a common goal: peace in the Holy Land between two free and secure states, Palestine and Israel. We've seen important progress towards peace over the last 13 months, and we see even more progress today here in Washington and in the region as well. Today, the government of Israel announced that it will be taking down more of the checkpoints that are making it difficult for Palestinians to travel to their jobs and schools. In addition, Israel will consider ways to reduce the impact of the security fence on the lives of the Palestinian people.
Mr. President, we remain committed to the roadmap, and we are implementing our security and reform obligations, security for all Palestinians and Israelis, is an essential element in progress, and we will achieve security based on the rule of law. We have succeeded significantly where Israel, with its military might, has failed in reducing violence, and we will continue. Reform and institution building are an internal Palestinian priority. We do not merely seek a state, but we seek for a state that is built on the solid foundations of the modern constitution, democracy, transparency, the rule of law, and the market economy. We continue to negotiate with Israel on the implementation of its obligations. Some progress has been made, but movement needs to be made in terms of freeing prisoners, lifting the siege on President Arafat, Israeli withdrawal from Palestinian areas, and easing up freedom of movement to Palestinians.
Ladies first.
Ladies first, okay.
Ladies first, the Palestinians, they're saying that the biggest problems they have now are the 160 Israeli checkpoints that are suffocating the Palestinian community. Did you get any guarantees from Mr. President that he will pressure Israel in removing these checkpoints? And Mr. President, you said the settlements are an obstacle for peace. Will you pressure Israel to stop the settlement activity? When and how?
Well, let me start and then you can end.
Please.
We'll let my guest end. I just told you that we brought this issue up. I've constantly spoken out about the end of settlements. I have done so consistently. It's very important for us to continue to earn the confidence of each other. And I'm going to tell you point blank that we must make sure that any terrorist activity is rooted out in order for us to be able to deal with these big issues. Nobody is going to accept a situation in which they become less secure, whether it be the Palestinian people or the Israeli people. Security is the essential roadblock to achieving the roadmap to peace. And the reason I'm confident that we can achieve substantial progress and achieve the vision of two states living side by side in peace is because I believe that the Prime Minister and his team is interested in routing out terror. And so to answer your question, the more progress is made on terror, the more progress there may be made on difficult issues.
Excerpts from President George W. Bush and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas speaking to the press following their meeting in Washington earlier today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.